everyone at the back hear me? Raise your hands.
Yes.
Nice. Yes. That's pretty nice. Wicked. Can I take this
one? Just pull it like that. Just pull it towards you.
There we go.
Takes another hand.
Yeah, grab it like that this time. So that was it. Give him a hand from everyone. Okay, we're officially starting. Okay. And so, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Psychedelic Society of Edinburgh's 11th event. It's been almost a year since we launched the society in this very room. On the 13th of April last year, 500 curious beings turned up to hear Stephen Reed, who's the director and founder of the Society in London. They turned up to hear Katie McLeod, who is the National Training and Development Officer for the SDF, Scottish Drugs Forum. And they turned up to hear Professor David Nutt, you might have heard of him. They turned up to share their thoughts and research with us. The night was a great success and got us very excited for things to come. It seems fitting that we are here again, 500 strong. I see a few empty seats, they might turn up. But yeah, this room only takes 500 people, and we sold out last week, which is just ridiculous. So once again, it's great to see so many familiar faces in the crowd, and of course, lots of new ones. From the bottom and the top of my heart, I thank you all so much for being here. Not just in this room, but on this planet. It is a miracle that you all actually exist. Remember that. It truly is. As I said before, the Psychedelic Society of Edinburgh started last year. Ian and I, this guy here, along with a friend, attended the launch of the Society in London in November 2014. A few months later, Stephen, the director of the Society in London, was looking for people to start societies in other cities, so he naturally jumped at the chance. Since then, we've held monthly events ranging from storytelling, where brave souls turned up and shared their experiences with these sacred medicines and how they've helped them through dark times in their lives. We've had raising awareness days, where we've flyered about the benefits of psilocybin on the Royal Mile, to mainly tourists from America. we've had film screenings. We have filmed Neurons to Nirvana. We have screened A New Understanding, the Science of Psilocybin, which is a beautiful movie. We've also had a LEAP event. LEAP stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We had Jim Duffy talk for us, who was in the Strathclyde Police for 32 years. And he retired, and now he's joined LEAP and saying prohibition is absolute bollocks and we need to do something about it. And we've had social gatherings that have occasionally ended up in psytrance events. Yes. We are a psychedelic society. So support has grown and grown, and it's really heartwarming to see. There are now societies popping up throughout the UK. Please help us spread the word. I realise I'm rocking back and forth. The Society advocates the use of psychedelics as a tool for awakening to the underlying unity and interconnectedness of all things. We help campaign for the legal regulation of these substances and support research into the amazing benefits of psychedelics. We are huge supporters of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, the Beckley Foundation, the Hefter Research Institute, Breaking Convention, and many other organisations like this. On that topic, please feel free to get a photo taken with our MAPS leaflet. It's kicking around somewhere. It says, I support psychedelic science, after the talk. We hope to put together a big album and send it to MAPS, showing our support from Scotland. Now, I'll hand you over to my good friend and co-founder, coordinator person, Ian, to introduce tonight's speaker. Thank you.
So thank you, Neil. Yeah, you know, we joked last year about putting this event on
So actually, to be doing it now is very surreal. But yeah, thank you very much all for being here. Also, folk have travelled from the top and the bottom of the country, and also England and even Ireland. So thank you all very much for making the journey. To be back at this swanky location a year later with 500 wonderful people because of shared interest in and appreciation of psychedelics is just magnificent. So thank you again. So the excitement over tonight has been tremendous. And it's no surprise. Our speaker, born in Edinburgh, has been a journalist for many of the top papers in Britain and has written many fascinating books on the origins of humanity and consciousness in the last 30 years. He has also sold over 5 million copies of his books and has just released the long-anticipated Magicians of the Gods, which I highly recommend you all buy and read as soon as you can. You may also be aware of him by appearing on the massively popular Joe Rogan podcast series, or indeed from his mighty and famously banned TED Talk, which thankfully has now had millions of views on YouTube. Now, we only have a hall until 9:30 here, so and we will try and go over that if we can, because no one's going anywhere. So I'm keen to stop talking, but after the presentation we will have a Q&A, and if you have a book to be signed or would like a quick photograph, then there will hopefully be time. And also, if a fire situation presents itself, hopefully not, then it's out the doors and to the left. And also, if you can keep noise to a minimum, please, I'm sure you'll all behave very well, but keep your mobiles off and that kind of thing. And that's about it. So if you will join me in giving a warm welcome to the stage, Mr. Graham Hancock.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. First question, am I audible at the back? Good. I'm just recovering from a really horrendous chest infection. I'm still running a bit of a temperature, so if I have a coughing fit or if I lose my voice, you'll understand why. Okay, I hope. But I'll do my best not to. I want to thank the Psychedelic Society of Edinburgh for inviting me to give this controversial talk. And I think it's good that we're doing it in an establishment mainstream place like this, because this needs to become part of the mainstream conversation. And I know that all of us in this room are working towards that in our own ways. We can turn the lights down now. What I'm going to say tonight draws in some ways on material in three of my books. One of them is a novel in the middle, Entangled. A novel that I wrote after downloading the plot during a series of ayahuasca sessions. Strangest thing that ever happened to me, I have to say, because I was not a novelist, but over those 2 weeks in Brazil, I got a very strong message, and I ended up writing a novel, and I had a lot of fun doing it. Then Supernatural is my main book relating to psychedelics and altered states of consciousness, but there are elements of The Master Game here, which was a book that was originally titled Talisman. So, I'm showing this to make a point. Psychedelics are an extremely serious matter. They are not for children. They are for adults. There are certain privileges in our society that are reserved for adults, and I believe rightly so. And psychedelics are one of those. But I also believe that if we want to keep psychedelics and other substances out of the hands of children until they are ready for them, we need to legalize psychedelics. Keeping them illegal is the cause of the problem, not the solution to the problem. And I think everybody in this room shares that view, that the war on drugs is an absurd and nonsensical enterprise which has done vast harm over the last 40 years. Now, interestingly enough, if you go back to ancient Egypt, 1700 years ago, we have a schoolroom in the Dakhla Oasis in Lower Egypt, And there are Greek writings on its walls which include positive references to drugs. I think we cannot imagine that in our schools today. In context of a story from the Odyssey about the Trojan War, basically Helen of Troy is giving her guests opium, a drug that takes away grief and anger and brings forgetfulness of every ill. Whoever should drink this down when it is mixed in a bowl would not let fall a tear down his cheek in the course of that day, at least. In Crete, there was a poppy goddess, an opium poppy goddess, with the cuts in the side of the poppy that releases the sap. Of course, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, his famous poem, let's see if I can remember some of it. In Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where off the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea. As Coleridge was writing this poem under the influence of opium, a knock came on the door. It was the postman. He took delivery of a package. By the time he returned to his seat, he'd forgotten all the rest of the poem. So we only have a fragment. This fragment, with a good deal more not recoverable, composed in a sort of reverie brought on by two grains of opium in the fall of the year 1797. I don't like the title of William Eberton's book, Narcotic Plants, because largely we're not dealing with narcotic substances here. But nevertheless, it's an excellent book and I highly recommend it. For showing the use of plant-based substances in ancient civilizations. We're looking at some material from Egypt here. And here we have Nefertiti presenting an opium poppy heads to her husband, Akhenaten. I somehow can't imagine Queen Elizabeth presenting Prince Philip with opium poppy heads. And then here, these are datura flowers. This is the highly visionary datura plant. The rays of the datura flower are descending into the third eye, the forehead of this lady here. And then the blue water lily is all over ancient Egyptian art. And it's not just about its pleasing aroma. The blue water lily is a mild hallucinogen. And we know that the ancient Egyptians used it for visionary purposes. The way that the visionary properties can be released is to infuse it in wine, for example. And traces of a liquid extract from the blue water lily were discovered in alabaster jars stored in Tutankhamun's tomb. We're looking at the ancient Egyptian tree of life here. And here we see the god Thoth, the god of wisdom, the inventor of writing. And he is writing the name of the pharaoh Seti I on the tree of life. You can see this relief in the temple of Karnak at Luxor in that region. Effectively saying that the pharaoh Seti I has earned the life of millions of years, the immortality. The tree of life has recently been identified by my good friend Dennis McKenna, who's the brother of the late, great Terence McKenna. Dennis is an ethnopharmacologist, and he's identified this tree, and it's Acacia nilotica. And it turns out that it is rich in dimethyltryptamine in DMT. Now, it's a bit of an operation to get the DMT out of the bark of that tree, for some chemistry. And academics have said the ancient Egyptians, they would never have had the chemical knowledge to release the DMT from the bark. So this is the moment when we need to ask ourselves, where actually do we get the word chemistry from? It comes from the ancient name of Egypt, which was Kemet. The Arabs referred to Al-Kemet, which became alchemy, and the very word chemistry comes from the name of ancient Egypt. So I'm quite sure the ancient Egyptians were able to extract the DMT from the tree of life. And we can therefore say that we do actually know what the ancient Egyptians were smoking. Tutankhamun's tomb again. This is an extraordinary relief on the second shrine. We see the initiate, again, connected through the third eye, through rays to stars in the sky. It's an intensely visionary scene. And speaking of the third eye, the pineal gland, it's interesting, this is a meme going around on the internet, but it's interesting to look at the eye of Horus and to compare it with the structure of the pineal gland, and indeed this pine cone or the staff of Osiris, all of them are pineal references. And the pineal gland, we'll be talking a bit more about it later, but it seems the ancient Egyptians may have known something that science says they shouldn't yet have known. This is Tiwanaku in Bolivia, at an altitude of 14,000 feet above sea level. It's a giant, mysterious ancient site, which I've talked about a lot in my Lost Civilization books. There are a number of statues in Tiwanaku, like these, the Ponce and Bennett monoliths, for example. And you know, the Ancient Aliens crew on that Ancient Aliens TV show, they like to say these are alien ray guns that they're holding here. But I'm afraid that that's not what they are. Actually, what they are is snuff trays for Anadinanthera snuffs, for snuffing DMT, basically. And indeed, snuff trays of that sort are still found in the Amazon today. And Dr. Manuel Torres is the person who's done the research and identified what was really going on at Tiwanaku. This pyramid site is about 60 miles north of Lima in Peru. It's all been excavated in the last 10 years. It's just an extraordinary complex of roughly the same antiquity as the complex of Giza in Egypt. And archaeologists were stunned to discover no evidence of warfare whatsoever. This was a society that cooperated with its neighbors and had nurturing and positive relationships with its neighbors. And perhaps we shouldn't be surprised when we discover that their imports included hallucinogenic snuffs from the Amazon. The Amazon. Francisco de Orellana was a Spanish conquistador. And he found himself at the mouth of the Amazon in the 1500s, 1540s. He went with 20 men in a little longboat on what they thought was a one-day hunting expedition. The Amazon River disagreed. And 4,000 miles later, they emerged in the Atlantic Ocean, having traveled the entire course of the Amazon. Along the way, Orellana reported seeing huge cities and evidence of sophisticated cultures. And for centuries afterwards, historians said that he'd made that all up, that it was just complete nonsense. He did it to aggrandize his own journey. But the tragic clearances of the Amazon are revealing to us the truth, that the Amazon has always been a human-managed environment, and that it did support very large urban settlements at one time. And something else, they have found this most mysterious soil distributed around the Amazon basin. Rainforest soils are normally not very good for agriculture, but there are spots in the Amazon that's just perfect for agriculture. And that's because of this ancient soil, which goes back at least 11,000 years, and it turns out it's a man-made soil. That it constantly reinvigorates its own fertility as a result of this. So there's something was going on in the Amazon more than 10,000 years ago that's really very intriguing. And again, emerging from the rainforest, we can see these huge geoglyphs and indeed even stone circles are appearing in the Amazon. So there's a hidden history there we need to know more about. It's estimated that there's about 150,000 different species of plants and trees in the Amazon. And it's the shamans of the Amazon who are really the experts in those plants and trees. And I'm here with Francisco Montesuna. I think that our screen, Ian, has just zoomed out again. I'm with Francisco Montesuna, and we are crouched down beside a bush that is known in the Amazon as chacruna. Botanically, it's Cicotria viridis, and the leaves contain a reasonable proportion of dimethyltryptamine, of DMT. Now, if I were speaking to any other audience, I couldn't take this knowledge for granted. I'm sure that almost everybody, perhaps everybody in this room knows this, that DMT is not normally orally active, that the monoamine oxidase enzyme in our gut neutralizes DMT. So what you want, if you're going to take DMT orally, is a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. And it's the case that if you made a tea out of the leaves of this plant, it would have no effect on you whatsoever because of that enzyme action in the gut. But the other element of the ayahuasca brew, the ayahuasca vine, contains a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. So when you mix the two of them together, the leaves and the vine, and cook it up in a pot with water, you get ayahuasca, the vine of souls, with orally active DMT as the key active ingredient. These days it's usually poured off into plastic bottles, anybody who's drunk ayahuasca, looking at those plastic bottles, will probably be having a little shudder right now, because the taste, of course, is truly horrendous. The smell is really bad as well. I would say essence of old socks, battery acid, sulfur, some raw sewage, and just a hint of chocolate. That's the ayahuasca taste. And then, of course, it's going to make you vomit. It's going to give you diarrhea. Why would anybody do this? We'll come on to it. There's another form of ayahuasca, yaje, which is made with a slightly different ingredients. The ayahuasca vine is involved, and another vine, Diplopteris camerana, provides the DMT. But somewhere way back in the Amazon, I do not believe by trial and error, out of those 150,000 different plants and trees, the shamans put together the two or three that can produce this extraordinary medicine that is making its way around the world and changing the world day by day. We're in the highlands, in the Andes here, on our way from the coast of Peru to Chavín de Huántar. Again, we're about 14,000 feet up here. Then you drop down into Chavín. And there's a message there. In this town of Chavín lies a great edifice made of well-carved stones of notable grandeur. And beneath the ground are great halls and rooms so great that there are certain stories they extend beneath the river and pass near the Huaca, or ancient shrine. Turns out that these stories are true, that Chavín is full of these underground galleries. In fact, they devoted their greatest efforts to the creation of places like this, with rather scary bits of statuary found inside them. So what were they doing? Why were they creating these underground galleries? Well, we know why. Because their psychedelic of choice was the San Pedro cactus, where the active ingredient is mescaline. And they were creating a setting for the Huachuma experience. The setting is at least as important as the substance. And in those darkened galleries, extraordinary experiences would have unfolded. And if we're in any doubt, we can see the iconography prominently features the San Pedro cactus. More art, deal with a peyote button from Monte Alba, peyote ball from Western Mexico. Again, the peyote cactus, the active ingredients, is also mescaline, as it is with the San Pedro cactus. And Palenque, the pyramid of the inscriptions, part of Maya culture. Let's not say that the Maya use of psychedelics brought them culturally low. The Maya were one of the great cultures of antiquity, and the use of psychedelics were absolutely central to their operation. These Maya mushroom stones speak for themselves. Psilocybin mushrooms from Guatemala, pre-classic Maya, about 500 BC. And then if we go to the predecessor culture of the Maya, the Olmecs, who left us these extraordinary pieces of statuary. If I were giving my lost civilization talk, I'd have a lot to tell you about this one. They left us these extraordinary pieces of statuary. The Olmecs, their favorite psychedelic was Amanita muscaria, the fly agaric. And we can see, again from their art, an Olmec baby weird jaguar wearing an Amanita muscaria mushroom cap, and right, Amanita muscaria transforming into the jaguar god, about 1200 BC. Has everybody heard of Soma?
Yeah.
It's prominently referenced in the Vedas, in the ancient Indian texts. And really very mysterious, what is this substance that connected humanity with the gods, was associated with blinding light? What was what was going on here. Well, finally, the study was done, a really in-depth study. Argonne, Wasson, and others investigated this, and the conclusion they came to is very clear, that actually what soma was Amanita muscaria. It was the Amanita muscaria mushroom, which was turned into a drink. Now, let me tell you something about the Amanita muscaria mushroom. If you want to have a journey with the Amanita muscaria mushroom, it's better to pass it through a human body first. That's what the shamans of the Tungus Mongol do with Amanita muscaria. They eat the mushroom, and then they pee it out into bowls, and then members of the group will drink the urine. As a matter of fact, it's been established that you can pass, the Amanita muscaria does not lose its potency until it's been passed through 7 human bodies. Seems that the body filters out many of the toxins, and you get a much purer psychedelic in the urine than you get taking it alone. At any rate, one of the key bits of evidence in the Vedas is a reference to the priests drinking soma and then pissing soma. Well, you drink tea and you piss urine, but when you drink Amanita muscaria, you're passing through the purely potent substance. Of course, the case is much more detailed than that, but that's an important part of it. Eleusis in Greece, now a sad ruin about 30 miles outside of Athens, was the beating heart of the Greek world. If we in the West and our politicians who are presently waging war on drugs all admire Greeks, the ancient Greeks, and Greek democracy, so perhaps they should be educated that psychedelics were absolutely at the heart of everything that was wonderful about ancient Greece. And Eleusis speaks to that. Cicero wrote, "Athens has given nothing to the world more excellent or divine than the Eleusinian mysteries." Pindar, "Happy is he who, having seen these rites, goes below the hollow earth, for he knows the end of life and he knows its God-sent beginning." Other initiates included Plato, Aristotle, Sophocles. Sophocles wrote, "Thrice happy are those mortals who, having seen these rites, depart for Hades, for them is alone is granted to have a true life there." What we now know from the research is that the potion that the initiates at Eleusis were given to drink was essentially LSD. It was Claviceps paspalum, which is a non-poisonous form of ergot containing LSD-like visionary alkaloids. We shouldn't be surprised to find the use of psychedelics at the heart of so many advanced ancient civilizations, because actually psychedelics appear to have played a key role in the emergence of modern human behavior. And this was the essential point that I was making in my book, Supernatural. This is what I call 6 million years of boredom. This is the family tree from the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee through to anatomically modern human beings. And for most of this period, our ancestors were just incredibly dull, very, very boring creatures who you would not want to have dinner with. They invented the first stone tools about 2.5 million years ago, but having invented them, they stuck with them without any change at all for the next 1 million years. So this tells us two things. Cultural information was being passed on, and the people who were passing it on were incredibly rigid and narrow-minded, and they weren't thinking outside the box. And then when you do get a change, the Acheulean tool tradition, well, it sticks for 1 million years as well. And it's not until the great cave art is introduced, you start seeing the first hints about 100,000 years ago, but you really have to go to 40,000 years ago, unless this is Lascaux, it's about 17,000 years ago. To see that something has changed. We are not dealing with simply repetitively passing on stone tools. We're seeing extraordinary symbolic art in these vast underground cathedrals. We are dealing with creatures exactly like ourselves. And it's interesting, if we look at the art, that the oldest surviving cave art in the world depicts creatures that are part human and part animal in form. The technical term is a therianthrope, from the Greek therion, which means wild beast, and anthropos, which means man. So from Fumani Cave in Italy, we have this upright human figure, but with the head and horns of an auroch, an extinct species of of Bull. And here, Hollenstein Stadel cave, Germany, 32,000 years old, a lion man, creature part lion and part human. And this is from Chauvet cave in France, again, it's about 32,000 years old. And it's really interesting to analyze this. First of all, we see a bison's head here, but attached to a human body. So this is bison man. And he is straddling a female figure, a prominent pubic triangle there. But oddly, the female figure is headless, except that her right arm is transforming into the head of a lion. Okay, so I think it's safe to say that this is not something that you see every day when you're out hunting in fields. What we're looking at is a moment of shape-shifting here, a female transforming into a lion and about to make love with a bison man. And then perched on, and now we're in, that's in France, now we're in South Africa, perched on a zigzag in the Cedarberg, we have humans transforming into antelopes. And here in the Drakensberg, it's a bit difficult to see if you're back in the room, but human bodies, antelope heads, this one's wrapped around with two serpents, both of which have got antelope heads, and this one's growing a feather out of its back. Where do ideas like this come from? What's the explanation for ideas like this? Why is there a grid, a geometric grid, between these two ibexes in Lascaux? What about these flows of dots and window shapes running down the walls of El Castillo Cave in Spain? Well, what cracked this, what's helped science to understand what's going on with the cave art, was indeed research using hallucinogenic drugs, LSD, DMT, mescaline. I feel angry with myself for even saying the words hallucinogenic drugs. I think we should stop using those words altogether. It's kind of habitual, but I just said it. LSD, DMT, mescaline, psilocybin, etc., to induce altered states of consciousness in human volunteers. And what emerged from these studies were very definite universal issues that initially geometric patterns would be seen, scintillating zigzags and wavy lines and starbursts and internested curves and so on and so forth. Then they might begin to take a bit of form. Then there's a sense of passing through a vortex into a seamlessly convincing parallel world inhabited by intelligent entities who communicate with us, apparently telepathically. And this volunteer on mescaline, I believe it was, drew the entity that he encountered, put him in a modern business suit, and gave him the head of a fox. So not different, really, from the lion man or the bison man from the painted caves. And we begin to understand the strange art of the painted caves. It's an art of visions. The shamans were entering deeply altered states of consciousness. They were experiencing visions, returning to the alert problem solving state of consciousness. They then painted those visions on the cave walls. And the academic work behind this, the leading figure is Professor David Lewis Williams at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. And I'm just summarizing quickly what he's come to: the specific characteristics of cave art, the therianthropes, the distinctive patterns, suggest this was an art of visions. David argues that it was the work of prehistoric shamans who'd experienced altered states of consciousness and afterwards set out to document their visions. This is really the strongest theory of what cave art is all about. And if you want to go into it in depth, here are some of David's books. Inside the Mind in the Cave is the one to read, really. That's the best one. So the point is that the art itself bears witness to the use of psychedelics in deep prehistory. But if we wanted further proof of that, New Scientist trumpeted this in March 2011 as the earliest evidence for magic mushroom use in Europe, psilocybin hispanica on the walls of a painted cave in Spain. As this art appears, everything else about humanity changes as well. Stone tools, hunting tactics, spiritual ideas. For example, before the art appears, our ancestors weren't burying their dead. Then they suddenly start burying their dead, and they start burying them with grave goods, with food, with water, which suggests that they've got some concept that some aspect of the individual survives death and goes on. All of these things took a quantum leap forward at the same time that our ancestors began to record typical visionary experiences in their art. It's probable that this is when human languages first evolved. Now, what we can say is that the use of psychedelics and these developments in human behavior correlate very, very closely. It's another step to say that psychedelics caused this. Personally, I think they did. I think psychedelics was what put us on the path to modern humanity, but we can say for sure that there's a close correlation. In the light of the evidence from the painted caves, I think we need to take a fresh look at ancient art from all around the world. It seems that psychedelics have played a much greater role in the story of civilization than has hitherto been admitted. Here's a ceramic from Ecuador where we see this curious figure, and its arm is transforming into a serpent, so reminiscent of the figure from Chauvet Cave where the woman's arm is transforming into the head of a lion. A bird-headed figure seated on a throne from the Maya, Olmec stone figure with feline features and so on and so forth. These are classic visionary images. And then go back into mythology, Theseus slaying the Minotaur. Everybody's heard the story, but wherever do you encounter creatures with human bodies and the heads of bulls? Regularly in visions, but not really anywhere else. Here we have a bull man wrestling with a lion in a cat, 1800 BC. All these figures from ancient Babylon. And of course, all of the ancient Egyptian gods were classic therianthropes, whether it's Thoth with his ibis head, or whether it's Anubis, the guide of souls, jackal-headed Anubis, the great Sphinx is a therianthrope. And here, this deceased lady is looking at her own soul. It's a beautiful vision. The ancient Egyptians envisaged the soul as having many different aspects, and one aspect of the soul was the ba soul, the bird, which could fly free, liberated from the chains of the body. And here she's looking at her own soul in the form of a ba bird. So, in the light of all this, in the light of the fact that psychedelics have clearly been involved in positive ways with human culture since the very beginning, I think it's reasonable to wonder, why is our society so rabid about consciousness-altering drugs and plants? Particularly when the psychedelics are concerned, what is it that those in power are really afraid of? Because look, it's a serious criminal offense to possess dimethyltryptamine, whether in smokable form or as part of the ayahuasca brew. Yet, as we'll see, DMT is a natural brain hormone. We're all already illegal in this room. And its function remains unknown for lack of research. So it seems absurd that a human being's life can be ruined simply for possession of this substance. It seems a very odd thing, and it seems to be out of step with the human story. And it's even odder when we realize that our society is not against altered states of consciousness as such. On the contrary, our society allows the big pharmaceutical companies to make billions every year from churning out consciousness-altering drugs. And this unholy alliance between big pharma and psychiatry is worrying as well, where every year psychiatrists invent new mental illnesses that big pharma will provide more consciousness-altering medicines supposedly to remedy. So, you know, we have Prozac and Ciroxat, so-called antidepressants or Ritalin to manage attention deficit disorder. These are consciousness-altering drugs, but they're completely legal in our society. They're damn dangerous drugs as well. The linking of suicidal mentation and suicidal actions to the SSRIs is very clear, and yet they're still completely legal and promoted in our society. And then, of course, we have a love affair with alcohol. Arguably, the world's most boring drug. Glamorized in our society, promoted, associated in positive ways with all kinds of lifestyles. A damn dangerous drug. Alcohol is an extremely dangerous drug. It kills huge numbers of people every year. Our politicians tell us that they made psychedelics illegal because they're dangerous to protect us. So why is alcohol legal then? Because it is definitely dangerous. It does kill huge numbers of people, whether from cirrhosis of the liver or in road accidents or just mindless, stupid violence. And yet, perfectly okay in our society for anybody to drink themselves into a stupor and vomit all over their friends. Many different states of consciousness are available to us. We are complex creatures. We are not one-dimensional creatures. That's part of the human birthright, this complexity. What our society values and glorifies is what I call the alert problem-solving state of consciousness. Now let me be clear that I'm not against the alert problem-solving state of consciousness. It has its place. It's important. When I get on an aircraft, I would like the pilot to be in an alert problem-solving state of consciousness. And I would like him to stay in that state all the way through the flight. After he lands, I don't care what he does with his head. But while he's flying me, I want him alert and problem solving. Has its place. The problem is that our society has given an over-monopolistic dominance to the state of consciousness. I think that's why alcohol and antidepressants are tolerated. They don't challenge the alert problem-solving state of consciousness. They may even support the dominance of that state. Psychedelics tend to lead to questioning of the established control system in our society and the states of consciousness that serve it. Now my remote control has failed, so I will move over here. Oh my God. The Sheraton have sent me a message. I'm not going to read it. Okay. So, bear that in mind. Psychedelics lead to questioning of the established control system of our society. And let's go and just give a few minutes thought to the Gnostics, a heretical sect of the early centuries of the Christian era. Gnosticism, we know about it at all in depth in its own voice because of a find that was made near here, near the Temple of Hathor at Dendera in Upper Egypt, at a place called Nag Hammadi, where was found a trove of Gnostic texts which had been buried round about the 400s AD. Now, this was a time when Christianity had become the dominant religion in Egypt, but the Gnostics regarded themselves as Christians, but they had a radically different take on the whole religious project. And the faction of Christianity that became the Roman Catholic Church had come to power, and it began a massive persecution of the Gnostics. The first burnings at the stake were carried out, and the Gnostics were driven underground. And at some point, some of them chose to bury a library of their texts, the so-called Nag Hammadi Library, and these were buried, as I say, near Dendera, and they were not recovered until 1945. Until 1945, all we knew about the Gnostics came down to us from those who had persecuted them. There was a view that Gnosticism hated the material world. We now know that that's not the case. There was a very complicated religious idea, and I don't have time to go into it in depth here, but essentially there's this spiritual realm and gradual increasing densities of matter. And one of the aeons, the great goddesses of the Pleroma, of the All, began to envisage a singularity. She began to dream the Anthropos. She began to dream of humanity. And in that dreaming, she fell from the cosmic realm into the realm of matter. And she manifests as the earth. So it's impossible for the Gnostics to hate the earth, since the earth herself is the goddess that they regarded so highly. In her fall, a kind of cosmic accident occurred, and an entity was formed who the Gnostics called the Demiurge. And from the Gnostic point of view, it's the Demiurge that we have been taught to worship through all of the mainstream religions. I got another bloody message from the show. Maybe I'll press cancel and I'll go on. Okay. So what they're saying is that the entity that the mainstream religions call God, or Yahweh, or Jehovah, or Allah, isn't God at all. God is up there in the Pleroma, in the distant cosmic realm. This is a minor supernatural who has imposed himself upon mankind. He's jealous, he's envious, he wants the worship of mankind. And most of all, he wants to snuff out the divine spark within us. The divine spark that would allow us to liberate ourselves from his control. And so the project of the Demiurge and his archons is to mislead and enslave mankind and to work to prevent us from ever awakening to our true potential. So the activities of the archons of the Demiurge is to spread fear and hatred and suspicion amongst us and to drive us into all manner of reckless crime, into wars and frauds and all things hostile to the nature of the soul. Now, interestingly, if we look at the Gnostic story of the Garden of Eden, they turn everything upside down in the Gnostic story of the Garden of Eden. We'll come to that in a moment. But what's fascinating is the Tree of Life from the Gnostic perspective. The Tree of Life is an Amanita muscaria mushroom. It's a psychedelic mushroom. And in the Gnostic story of the Garden of Eden, we're brought up to believe that the serpent was the bad guy. From the Gnostic point of view, the serpent was the good guy. Because what the serpent is saying to Adam and Eve is, if you are to grow and develop as souls, you must have knowledge of good and evil. You will be defined by your choices. If you stay in this state where you have no knowledge of good and evil, you will have no possibility of progressing and developing. And in that sense, the knowledge of good and evil is essential to the progress of the soul. And so from the Gnostic point of view, the serpent was doing Adam and Eve a favor. And then the Demiurge intervenes, as we know, and Adam and Eve are driven out of the garden and prevented from ever returning to the garden in case they find their way to the Tree of Life. The flood in the Gnostic scheme of things wasn't inflicted to punish evil, but to punish humanity for having risen so high and to take the light, the gnosis that was growing amongst men. The survivors were thrown into great distraction and into a life of toil so that mankind might be occupied with worldly affairs and might not have the opportunity of being devoted to the Holy Spirit. Throughout history, those who've sought the liberating gnosis, the light, knowledge of the true nature of things, have been persecuted. Let me give you an example of that persecution. It concerns an amazing culture that established itself in southwest France in the 1100s, 1200s, called the Cathars. They were based around here in the Languedoc. It was an incredibly advanced culture. They believed in universal literacy. They were the first papermakers. They spread knowledge of writing. They believed in absolute equality between men and women. They created wonderful poetry. The troubadours came from the Cathars. In many ways, they were an incredible, ideal, and beautiful society, but they had one problem. They believed that the Pope was the devil's agent on earth. And that was a dangerous thing to believe in the 13th century. And as a result, the Roman Catholic Church sent down a crusade to destroy the Cathars. This resulted in a terrible genocide, the burning and destruction of the Cathar cities, the wiping out of the Cathars, and the burning and destruction of all of their books, and all of this being done in the name of God. So from the Gnostic point of view, the Demiurge and his archons and their human servants are always trying to steal the light, and are certainly doing so today. And from the Gnostic point of view, if the light is growing amongst mankind today, then we can be sure that tremendous archonic forces are working to suppress it. If the Gnostic scenario were correct, then how might we expect these forces to manifest? Not wishing to cause any offense, but I would say one of the ways they manifest is through the three big monotheistic faiths, which are not these days, in any way, as far as I can see, about the liberation of the human soul, but rather about control. And these religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, they all talk the talk of peace and love. But the walk they walk is often very different, has been very different down through history, whether it's the burnings at the stake of Christianity, the last burning of a witch was in the 1700s, or whether it's the sex abuse scandals in the Roman Catholic Church, or whether it's Islam stoning women to death because they've looked at another guy, you know? And then we have the mass murder of the Yazidis by so-called Islamic State, this Abrahamic death cult, yet another Abrahamic death cult. And then, of course, the state itself is another archonic agent. What is the state? What is government? An effort to remove from us responsibility for our own choices and our own actions, and to devolve that on officials, and to take our money and to spend it in the way that the state decides rather than the way that we as individuals may decide. The state is about disenfranchising individuals from their freedom and from their liberty. And of course, states operate vis-a-vis one another by multiplying fear and hatred and suspicion. They're constantly pressing the patriotism button. I don't know about you guys, but I think patriotism's a really disgusting thing. I have no sympathy for patriotism whatsoever. Why should I like somebody more because they happen to be born on the same bit of land I was, or under the same bit of government that I was? Isn't what matters the ideas that we all share? Isn't it time we moved beyond patriotism and love of country and started to consider love of fellow humanity without division into nations? I'm not speaking for world government, by the way. I don't want any government. I want absolutely the most minimal government possible. That's not what I'm talking about, but what I am talking about is humanity and our connections to one another. And then, of course, there are the big corporations. They are also disenfranchising us from ourselves, and, of course, the media, with this endless, miserable, depressing, ugly, rolling news designed to convince us that the world is full of ugliness and that there is no joy or hope. And all of these forces, I would say, have conspired in the 21st century to create a kind of consciousness monopoly. And I think it's dangerous to give a monopoly to a single state of consciousness, and to enforce that monopoly with draconian criminal sanctions is possibly even suicidal. So, the alert problem-solving state of consciousness is good, as I said, for a number of things like flying airplanes. It's good for politics, it's good for commerce, it's good for warfare, it's good for all of those things. But the promise of this state of consciousness, that it would bring us endless security, endless prosperity, a bright future, we all know now that that's not true. Having gone through the last financial crisis, we know that the bankers can't go on just magically printing electronic money forever to make the problem go away. Ours is a society that is just quite insane in many ways, with the spreading of the horrors of pollution. Only a society that was truly insane, having invented nuclear weapons, could allow them to proliferate. A sane society would get rid of nuclear weapons immediately, these horrible, toxic, death-dealing things. And the alert problem-solving state of consciousness of the society based on it, we can't even solve the problem of hunger on a worldwide scale. And look what we're doing to the rainforests. Look what we're doing in the Amazon, the incredible destruction that's taking place there, that there seems no way of halting, that is driven by economics. It would be possible for the wealthy countries to fund the peoples of the Amazon, never to cut down another tree. It wouldn't cost that much money. But we're too busy spending it on warfare and mass destruction and the multiplication of fear and hatred and suspicion. So we simply stand by while this sacred realm and this home of biodiversity on Earth is destroyed. We throw up our hands in horror, but we do nothing about it. So I don't think we're going to be able to move to a new state of consciousness using the old state of consciousness laden down with these archonic constraints. We're going to have to throw off those constraints. We're going to have to transcend the old state of consciousness completely. Gnosticism won't help. It's dead and gone. But in unexpected places, there are still people we can learn from. And those places include the Amazon rainforest, where there are still uncontacted tribes. And my first experiences with ayahuasca were in the heart of the Amazon jungle. And way back then, I talked with the shamans many, many times about the state of the world and the sickness of the West. Don't imagine because people in the live in the Amazon that they don't know what's happening in the outside world. They absolutely do. And we talked about this, and I asked them, what are the things that's wrong with the advanced urban societies? And they said, it's really simple. You've severed your connection to spirit. And they propose a remedy for this problem, which is ayahuasca, a portal to enchanted realms via a shudderingly awful taste. So, as you're vomiting and, you know, running behind a tree, we in the West are very inhibited about our bodies, obviously. But the message that ayahuasca brings home is that we are ultimately our bodies. We are our consciousness. And at the level of consciousness, what's happening with ayahuasca is really extraordinary. And for those who haven't drunk ayahuasca, Pablo Amarillo's amazing paintings of his ayahuasca experiences bring to life that enchanted, sentient, supernatural realm. And many artists around the world are now picking up the ayahuasca message. I'm privileged to be close friends with Alex Gray, and also with the late, great Robert Venosa, artists whose work has been transformed by the ayahuasca experience. And the message that they put across is one of those universals that everyone who drinks the brew sooner or later reports, and it's about the sacred, magical, enchanted nature of all creation and the interdependence of material and spiritual realms. Ayahuasca can be personally quite tough because what tends to happen is that you go through episodes in your life, you have a kind of life review, and you suddenly start seeing yourself from the other person's point of view. You know, you may have justified those harsh words or actions that you aimed at another person. It may have seemed perfectly reasonable to you at the time. Ayahuasca will show you the other side of the story. It will show you how much those words hurt that person, the pain and suffering you caused. That's why people cry a lot during ayahuasca sessions, because they are suddenly realizing how toxic they've been to others. And it fills you with a strong will to change your behavior. It is very difficult to change a lifetime of bad habits. Very difficult. But ayahuasca at least offers you the opportunity to begin that process. That's when the work really begins, after the session, integrating what you've learned, not the session itself. Then, of course, most of us in this room are aware of this. Ayahuasca is incredibly effective at getting people off addictions to hard drugs, whether heroin or cocaine. The Takiwasi Clinic in Tarapoto in Peru is doing an excellent job of de-addicting heroin addicts. Typically, a dozen sessions over a month will do it. They leave free of withdrawal symptoms and never return to their addiction. Nonetheless, Western medicine is still delivering methadone to heroin addicts, an incredibly inefficient way of dealing with heroin addiction, when ayahuasca can bring about a transformation. And the spirit of ayahuasca is most frequently encountered as a creative guide, as a healer, as a moral teacher. When I started speaking about her, about Mother Ayahuasca, as some kind of real entity, I think that's why my TED Talk got banned, because that was considered to be unscientific. But actually, what does science know about this? People all around the world have had the experience of encountering a loving entity who wants them to do better with their lives. How can we explain this? What's going on? Is it just a figment of our brains on drugs? Or is something much, much more happening? So this leads us to ask, what actually are we doing here? What journey are we on? What is consciousness? What happens to me when I die? What is reality? And right there, we have to say consciousness is a mystery. We know the brain's involved in it, definitely involved in it in some way, but it's unclear as to exactly how. Now, there's a very substantial view in mainstream science that the brain makes consciousness the way a generator makes electricity. And, And when I've talked to medical doctors about this, they say it's obvious that the brain makes consciousness. And I say, why is it obvious that the brain makes consciousness? And they say, well, look, if I damage part of your brain, or if part of your brain is damaged by a virus, it's going to affect your consciousness. So it's obvious that the brain is making consciousness. But is it that obvious? Because isn't it possible that the relationship between the brain and consciousness is more like the relationship between the TV signal and the TV set? Yes, if we damage the TV set, the picture is damaged, but not the signal. The signal remains pure. And right now, the state of consciousness research cannot say which of the two models is correct. What is reality? There's Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD. And he's saying reality is inconceivable without an experiencing subject, product of the exterior world and of a receiver, an ego, in whose deepest self the emanations of the exterior world become consciousness. Conscious. Maybe there's more to the exterior world than our senses can register. Certainly William Blake felt that when he said if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite, for man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks in his cavern. William James, brother of the novelist Henry James, great psychologist, experimented with nitrous oxide in 1901. It led him on a very interesting path of thought that these other states of consciousness can be unleashed in an instant. And he's saying that our normal waking consciousness, rational consciousness, is but one special type of consciousness. There lie other forms of consciousness all around. And he's saying that no account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness quite disregarded. At any rate, they forbid a premature closing of our accounts with reality. I think that's a really important point, because I think materialist reductionist Western science has prematurely closed its accounts with reality. Aldous Huxley regarded the brain as a reducing valve, that its primary function is to keep stuff out, to stop us from being overwhelmed by the massive impressions that would flow in. And he regarded psychedelics as gratuitous graces, which allowed some of us to bypass the reducing valve. And so he says, speaking of those bypasses, through these permanent or temporary bypasses, there flows something more than, and above all, something different from, the carefully selected utilitarian material which our narrowed individual minds regard as a complete or at least sufficient picture of reality. Back to Hofmann, and he's developing this receiver analogy. That the true importance of LSD and related hallucinogens lies in their capacity to shift the wavelength setting of the receiving self and thereby to evoke alterations in reality consciousness. And then Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico, his work with dimethyltryptamine and human volunteers in the 1990s, Rick coined the concept of channel normal, that we're all tuned in most of the time to channel normal, but that there are other channels broadcasting at us all the time which our receiver is not picking up, and that he's suggesting that what DMT does is it alters the receiver wavelength of the brain and allows us to admit into consciousness areas of reality that are normally closed to our senses. And these worlds, he says, are usually invisible to us and our instruments and are not accessible using our normal state of consciousness. However, just as likely as the theory that these worlds exist only in our minds is that they are in reality outside us and freestanding. If we simply change our brain's receiving abilities, we can comprehend and interact with them. Now, I've given this analogy many times, but I'd like to give it just once more here. When people tell you that the visions you experience are just your brain on drugs, how logical is that? See, this is what happens. A volunteer is put on LSD or DMT, and then they stick him or her in an MRI scan. I can't imagine any more ghastly place to have a DMT journey than in an MRI scan. And the MRI scanner reveals definite changes taking place in the brain, and the individual is reporting extraordinary experiences. So the scientist standing there says, oh, Those experiences that he'll report, he's reporting, those are just the changes in his brain. That's just the chemical and electrical changes in the brain which are producing those experiences. They have no reality to those experiences at all. So I think that's very poor logic, and I think this is a simple answer to that logic, is that if we want to look at a very distant star, we need a telescope, obviously. We're pointed at the right regions of the heavens, and then we're going to begin to focus it. And as we focus it, changes will take place, physical changes will take place inside the barrel of the telescope in the relationship between the lenses. Eventually the star will come into view. We'd be completely wrong to say that the star can be reduced to the physical changes inside the telescope. Those physical changes simply allowed us to see the star that was always there, but that we couldn't see before. And that's the suggestion with hallucinogens in the brain. Now, in these matters, 21st century science really has very little experience and very little valid or useful knowledge. The people we can learn from in this area are the shamans of tribal and hunter-gatherer societies. And altered states of consciousness, visionary states, trance states are the universal feature common to all shamanism everywhere. And in these altered states of consciousness, it's very common for shamans to report encounters with intelligent supernatural entities, which they usually construe as spirits. They might sometimes take human form, they might appear in the form of an animal, they might be a therianthrope, part animal, part human. And shamans of all cultures also report that they themselves transform into animals or therianthropes during their trance journeys in the spirit world. But here's a mystery. Many of the experiences that shamans report with spirits are very similar to the encounters with quote-unquote aliens reported by tens of thousands of people in the West who believe they've been abducted by UFOs. And the shamans themselves frequently depict UFOs and aliens, for example, in Pablo Amorico's picture here. And a classic one here, you know, with a classic shamanic therianthrope on the side, and then a flying saucer here. When I got Pablo Amorico's permission to use these images, he's passed away now, but I had a number of long conversations with him. And I asked Pablo, why are you painting flying saucers? What's going on with these flying saucers? Are you saying that people are coming here from other planets? And he said something very interesting. He said the flying saucers are vehicles for entering and leaving the spirit world. When a shaman speaks of the spirit world, that's pretty close to speaking of a parallel universe in modern scientific terms. Is there possibly some kind of interdimensional connection being revealed here? At any rate, if you want to know about the phenomenology of shamanism, Mircea Eliade's great work on shamanism is the go-to book. And we have a huge dossier on the experiences of people who've felt themselves to be abducted by aliens, thanks to the work of John Mack at the University of Harvard, David Jacobs, and Bud Hopkins. It's possible to compare these dossiers. So the spirits that shamans encounter most frequently appear in the form of animals, birds, or fish, or as therianthropes. And this turns out to be the case with UFO abductees. Listing a few examples here, Virginia Horton sees an intelligent gray deer. Another American reports seeing a deer looking at her through her window just before she's abducted. Another sees a wolf standing on her bed. And John Mack summarizes, the aliens appear to be consummate shapeshifters, often appearing initially to the abductees as animals, owls, eagles, raccoons, and deer are among the creatures the abductees have seen initially. Shamans report being floated up into the sky or climbing ropes of light into the skies, particularly strong in Bushman shamanism in Botswana. But UFO abductees feel that too. They feel they're being carried up into the sky, and very specifically, some of them report lines or threads of light, or climbing threads of light. How do we account for these similarities in these two apparently extremely different domains? Shamans, as well as being abducted to locations in the sky, are frequently abducted to locations underground and underwater. That also turns out to be the case with UFO abductees. And again, I won't read all of these, but you can read them for yourselves. There's number of examples here, whether you've heard of things find themselves underwater or in a cave. And then, of course, the classic feature of shamanism is the shamanic ordeal, that the spirits fall upon the shaman and cut him apart and disassemble him and insert objects under his skin and cut off his head and count his bones and all kinds of stuff like that. How different is that really from the painful piercings and surgical procedures that you've heard that he's reported? Again, I mean, here we have Sandra Larson, beings removed her brain and set it down beside her. And here we have a Yakut shaman, the spirits cut off his head, which they set aside, bone counting. Or again, the details are quite extraordinary. Shamans frequently report being abducted by spirits and having sex with spirits. As a matter of fact, I know a shaman in the Amazon whose wife has left him because of the stuff he does in the spirit world. He's got lots of women over there and kids as well. Again, this is true of UFO abductees too. UFO abductees again and again report sex with aliens, a lover in the alien realm, hybrid offspring to whom the abductees brought repeatedly, apparently in order to hold and cuddle his or her hybrid child. This is Alex Gray's painting for the cover of Rick Strassman's book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. Here is an image of a UFO sighting in the 60s, and this is the 12th century Rupertsburg Codex. Here in the sky, we see lots of eyes, which are a very common feature of the DMT experience, as a matter of fact, and stars. And then we see a line coming down out of this object, and it's descending into the womb of a woman down here. We see a child in the womb. And then up here, what do we see? A little elf and a mushroom. What's going on here? And what on earth is going on here? 1710, baptism of Christ. What's that up there? And is this the baptism of Christ or a shamanic initiation or what's happening here? And then mysterious books and a sense of mission and healing powers, they're common to these two domains as well. Maria Sabina was given a book by a spirit. She said she learned many things from the book, which helped her to do her work better. But the spirit wouldn't allow her to keep the book and to bring it back with her, and it remains in the sky. Betty Hill had the same experience. She was given a large book by the individual she identified as the leader of the aliens, but he took it back from her before she left the ship. Betty Andreasen was given a small blue book with 40 luminous pages, but soon afterwards it disappeared. And like shamans who've encountered spirits, many UFO abductees return with a sense of mission and responsibility for the deep knowledge and healing powers that they believe they've received. What about fairies and elves? What are they? Why have they got so much in common with aliens and spirits? A great work on this was published in 1969 by Jacques Vallée, Passport to Magonia. In my book, Supernatural, I then took the dossier that he brought up to 1969 on the phenomenology of these experiences and brought it fully up to date. And the point here is that let's look at these fairies. You know, from the Middle Ages until the 20th century, fairies, just like spirits and aliens, were renowned and feared for abducting people. You did not want to get too close to those fairies dancing in a ring. Were you to touch that dancing circle, you would find yourself transported into another world in an instant, in a flash. You'd be in another place. And there you might be entertained or looked after. Certain things might happen to you. You might think that 3 or 4 hours had passed. And eventually you'd be allowed to go back to your world. But then you'd discover that your world had changed. 500 years had passed in those 3 hours that you spent in fairyland. It's a bit like the missing time phenomenon with UFO abductees, except it seems the UFO abductions have got kinder. Now people just lose 5 hours, not 5 centuries. I sometimes wonder that, about that spinning process, which the flying saucers also do. Are we actually looking at some kind of technology, some kind of interdimensional technology, which is evolving? Fairies were sometimes cruel, tortured and hurt human beings, but they could also be kind and give gifts. Aliens do that as well. Fairies have the power of flight. They make use of aerial vehicles, flying boats, flying castles, flying carriages, etc. Fairies would often abduct people underground into the hollow hills. We can see the little doorway in the hills there. Here, this young man is being seduced by some fairy maids to enter fairyland. Interestingly, Amanita muscaria mushroom in the foreground there, a little clump of mushrooms here. I wonder if they're psilocybes. And of course, like aliens, spirits, fairies and elves often appear in the form of animals or therianthropes. There's Melusine, a very feared medieval fairy who was part serpent, part woman, and who abducted human children. Here from a woodcut from Holland, 15th century, a group of fairies dancing in a ring. They are classic therianthropes, part human, part animal in form, classic creatures of vision, really no different from the creatures of vision that we see on the painted caves. And here's an image from Angoulême in France. It's a human face, 27,000 years old. Just a hint of a dark eye, nose, a bit of a mouth, a high domed forehead. And then Peshmerga Cave. I was privileged to sit in front of this image for several hours in Peshmerga Cave. It's really extraordinary. What is this up here above it? And then look at the strange head of the creature. It's humanoid in form. Let's expand that head a little bit. Let's redraw it. And essentially it's that. And how different is that from the classic modern image of the alien grey? And then when you go to the painted caves as well, you find objects that archaeologists can't identify, like this one from Altamira or this one from Berdefal, but they look awfully like the flying saucers that Pablo Amerigo painted and described to me as vehicles for entering and leaving the spirit world. Three of these, there's three drawings here. One of them was drawn in 1990 by one of John Mack's volunteers. The others are about 20,000 years old, 15,000 years ago. Well, this is the modern image, and these are the ancient images. But I would suggest they're all inspired by the same experiences. Now we come to Rick Strassman, a really remarkable man. I know you're all very familiar with his work. He did the first work with human volunteers and DMT in the 1990s at the University of New Mexico. And it's really fascinating how many of the accounts of Rick's volunteers overlap into the realm of UFO abductions. So here's Jim, and he's saying, there were clinical researchers probing into my mind. There were sort of long fiber optic things they were putting into my pupils. Carl saw a lot of elves, prankish and ornery elves. Ben felt that something was inserted into his left forearm. Lucas found himself above a space station, and then he found entities inside the space station that were doing some kind of routine technological work and paid no attention to him. In a state of overwhelmed confusion, I opened my eyes. The terrible drawing at the bottom right here was done by me during an ayahuasca session in Brazil. It was the only time that I'd ever seen something that really looked like an alien. And there were flying saucers as well. And it was kind of up there above me, and I'm sitting on this bench in the jungle, and I just know that they're going to take me. I'm going to be abducted, and I'm terrified. And I open my eyes and I shout, "No!" And the vision vanishes. Of course, I should have kept my eyes closed and said, "Yes!" I should have girded up my courage and accepted that experience. But I didn't, and the alien-looking guys, they've never come back. But they're all over ancient art, these insect-like aliens. We find them in Tanzania, and more of the accounts of Rick's volunteers here. So, something very interesting. A number of the volunteers who were spoken to in the DMT state by what they construed to be intelligent entities, the intelligent entities said to them basically this: "We're so glad you discovered this technology. Now we can communicate with you more easily. DMT is an entirely natural product of the human body, but it's something quite unique. It's an endogenous human psychedelic. It's found in blood, plasma, urine, and cerebrospinal fluid. But we don't know its function, and that's largely because of lack of research. It's a Schedule 1 substance. But there is a definite association with the pineal gland. And Rick Strassman's recent work at the Cottonwood Foundation have firmed that association up quite a lot. It may be not that it's produced in the pineal gland, but that the pineal gland becomes a focus for the DMT. In evolutionary older animals such as lizards and amphibians, the pineal is called the third eye, and it actually possesses a lens, a cornea, and a retina. With the bird, it no longer sits on top of the skull, but it's still light sensitive. In humans, it's moved deeper into the brain. It's not directly sensitive to light anymore. My thought, maybe DMT is the lens on the pineal gland, which allows us a sixth sense, which allows us to transcend the physical senses and see beyond into other realities normally closed off to us. At any rate, Strassman recognized the remarkable similarities between the UFO abductees' reports and the reports of his own volunteers, who we know weren't physically abducted because they remained on a hospital bed in the University of New Mexico throughout the experience. So what Strassman proposed is that UFO abductees might be spontaneous overproducers of endogenous DMT. But in saying that, I would not be doing justice to my friend Rick if I didn't also point out that he's at pains to emphasize that this did not imply that such experiences mediated by DMT were in any way unreal, simply that we need to expand our definition of reality. And this brings us back to the issue of the retuning of the receiver wavelength of the brain. By conceiving of the brain as a receiver of information, one can accommodate the biological model of changing brain function with a chemical. At the same time, it allows for the possibility that what is being received, while not usually perceptible, is consistently and verifiably existent for a large number of individuals. It may indeed reflect stable, freestanding, and parallel planes of reality. So for human beings, we cannot see something without interpreting it. Interpretation is built into perception from the get-go. I would say with spirits, aliens, and fairies, with the reports of modern lab volunteers, what the evidence suggests is that we are looking at the same very ancient and long-lived phenomenon of human visionary experience witnessed through different cultural spectacles by different peoples. So the visions are clothed in the cultural spectacles of the time, but there's something universal and eternal about them. And from time to time, down the millennia, this has brought us the forbidden fruit of Gnosis and reawakened us to the true nature of things. And so what this says to me is that whatever psychedelics are, they are certainly not brain candy. Used responsibly with the right intention, they can be utterly transformatory. And it's pleasing now to see that medical science slowly is catching up with the incredible potential of these medicines. For all aspects of the human experience. The mystical properties of psilocybin absolutely confirmed. Psilocybin research moving into the mainstream in many, many areas. And I hope that this will be the first step in a gradual process of rehabilitating these sacred medicines and bringing them back to their place and bringing our culture back to balance, because our culture is a desperately unbalanced culture. And let's not forget that this Apple computer that I'm projecting this show on, we owe it to LSD, basically. Steve Jobs spoke about how taking LSD was one of the two or three most important things he'd ever done in his life. He hired programmers preferentially if they had LSD experiences. He knew they'd do a better job. In California, the connection between the psychedelic world and developing computer science was very obvious during the 70s. Steve Wozniak later described in Time magazine how he got the concept of Apple, the first microcomputer, during an LSD trip. This is now being denied by materialist productionist scientists, but There's a lot to suggest that the discoverer of the double helix made the breakthrough under the influence of LSD. Francis Crick told a friend that he had first perceived the double helix shape while he was on LSD. LSD was, of course, totally legal during the late 40s and the 50s when Crick was taking it. It's really fascinating to consider this. Of course, there were many aspects to the discovery of the double helix, but what Crick is saying is that the moment that he really got it was when he was under the influence of LSD. So if this is true, then one of the great scientific discoveries of the 20th century is not down to the alert problem-solving state of consciousness so much as it's down to the visionary state of consciousness. Back to the Gnostic story of the Garden of Eden and the knowledge, gnosis of good and evil being essential for the progress of the soul. And let's consider, again, the serpent in the Garden of Eden, who is a classic creature of vision. In almost every case, the serpent is depicted with a human head, a classic therianthrope kind of entity that you only see in visionary states. And that entity is bringing the message that we are here on Earth to learn and to grow and to develop. And in the process of learning and growing and developing, it's important that we take responsibility for ourselves and that we do have knowledge of good and evil. And for seeking that knowledge of good and evil, we are told in the Bible that Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden, and angels were posted at the entrances to the garden to prevent humanity from ever returning. And there's a really intriguing passage there. So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims and a flaming sword, which turned every way to keep the tree of life, because there's an eerie passage in Genesis where the entity that we are persuaded to believe is God speaks, we don't know who, and says why he's going to do this, why Adam and Eve are to be kept out of the garden. They've discovered the tree of knowledge of good and evil already, but that entity does not want them to discover the tree of life. And the statement is made, lest they become gods like us. Who are those us? What actually are we dealing with here? In all of this, somewhere hidden away, the mystery of the knowledge of good and evil and the mystery of immortal life, I would suggest, lie hidden. Thank you. There's a couple more points I wanted to make, and I'm going to make them, because what's at stake is not a small thing. A struggle is underway for the future direction of human consciousness, and we live in a society that will send us to prison if we make use of time-honored sacred plants to explore our own consciousness. Yet surely the exploration and expansion of the miracle of our consciousness is the essence of what it is to be human. I've made this point many times, and I'll make it again now. If we live in a society that does not allow us as adults to make decisions about our own bodies and our own consciousness while doing no harm to others, if we live in such a society, then we cannot be said to be free in any meaningful sense. If we have no sovereignty over our own consciousness, then every other form of sovereignty that we believe we have is an illusion. And this is why I think the issue of psychedelics and the legal status of psychedelics is so important in our society. Because we already have all the laws we need to deal with people who get out of control and get in the face of other people. And I support those laws, because we should not be getting in the faces of other people. But so long as we are working with psychedelics privately in our own way, doing no harm to others with respect and with love, then it is a grotesque abuse of our fundamental human right to cognitive liberty as adults, to impose prison sentences upon us for exploring our own consciousness. You know, if we're to heal the planet, then we're going to have to re-establish contact with spirit. And we're only going to do that if we first regain some of our consciousness. Otherwise, you know, who knows? Are we going to become the next lost civilization? I would say the choice is up to us. Thank you. That's very kind of you. So we're going to do some Q&A, and then afterwards, if anybody wants a quick word with me, I'll be sitting there. If anybody wants a book signed, I'm happy to sign it. If anybody wants anything signed apart from a check, I'm happy to sign that. Anybody wants any pictures, happy to do those as well. This is the age of social media, don't be shy. Okay, Q&A.
Okay, so
I wanted to ask you one of the things, but I just ask one.
Okay.
And what do you think is the connection between the ancient civilizations and opium, and the connection between opium and consciousness?
It's clear that opium was extensively used in the ancient world. And it's another one of those, in my view, another one of those allied plants. And what it seems to me that the help that opium offers us is with the management of pain. It's extremely good for that, and if I were to find myself in a terminal cancer situation, I would definitely go for opium or heroin or whatever was available to reduce the pain. I'd much rather do that than go through the hospital route. It's clear that there are visionary aspects to opium as well. I personally have no experience of opium or heroin, so I can't speak from experience in that way, but I think that nature has provided us with a whole range of allied plants which have different functions, and it seems to me that the function of the opium poppy, the most useful function for humanity, is primarily to do with the management of pain, and used for that purpose, it's extremely constructive and positive substance, in my view. But as I say, no personal experience on it. Yeah.
If you are wanting to try ayahuasca,
let's get you a microphone. Let's get you a microphone. Sorry, I shouldn't be choosing the questions. You should. All right, yeah. we'll vary. But here we'll give you the microphone. There you are. Yes.
Right.
Hands up.
If I wanted to use ayahuasca,
yeah.
Is it possible to get it in this country, or would I have to travel to Brazil or Peru? And do you know a good shaman that you would recommend?
The answer to both questions is yes. I don't rush to encourage people to do ceremony in the British Isles. I have had a number of extremely negative experiences during ceremony in the UK. And those negative experiences have been because the person facilitating the experience was primarily about making money. It's primarily about that. They're packing in a lot of people. I don't think an ayahuasca session with 50 people is manageable. I think it's good to keep ayahuasca sessions to a dozen or less. And preferably, because you know, all your barriers come down with ayahuasca, all the shields go down. That's how ayahuasca works. So you really want to be drinking with people you know, or who know people you know, people you can trust and feel at ease and comfortable with. There's a new phenomenon in ayahuasca circles that I've now come across more than once, which I call psychic vampires. It's people who are actually using the vulnerability of ayahuasca sessions to psychically dominate and control others. This is a very, very bad problem. And it's a problem that should be managed by the shaman or facilitator, but often is not managed by that person. So there are a lot of... All is not sweetness and light in the ayahuasca garden. There are a lot of people offering ceremony who really haven't got a clue what they're doing.
And I would never encourage somebody to buy the ingredients on the internet and make it at home. There's a deep cultural background to this. We should learn from that. So I do think that, you know, South America is the place to go, if possible. But that being said, there are some ceremonies being offered in the United Kingdom that are good. There are some people who are offering good ceremonies. I'm not going to recommend those. I'm not going to speak to that. I do have a fact sheet concerning retreats in Peru, Brazil, and Costa Rica that I can't give an unconditional guarantee, but the word I get on them, and some of them I've participated in, is good. And I'm happy to share that fact sheet. Well, I'll just send off, if anybody wants it, okay, here's my email address, gbhancock@gmail.com. Title, I don't know, fact sheet. I won't be able to get into detailed correspondence. I'm just overwhelmed these days. But I will send you the fact sheet if anybody wants it. And you can take it from there. Okay.
If someone was to go on their own ayahuasca experience, what age do you recommend they should be before they decide?
Well, I said at the beginning, I think, where are you, by the way? There you are. What age are you?
15.
15? I would say wait a few years. The ayahuasca will still be there. You'll have grown into it in a way that you might not be. It's one of those things that's really worth waiting for. It's worth getting yourself, you know, set a little bit on your path. A little bit. Because ayahuasca tends to cause you to question everything. And I wouldn't rush. Certainly when I was a teenager, I'm really glad I didn't have ayahuasca. But I think it's right and proper for adults. Where exactly the line of adulthood comes, whether it's 18, whether it's 21, I don't know exactly. I don't know. But I think 15 is a little bit too young. I would say definitely be over 18. I'm letting these guys choose the question. Okay.
Hello, Graham.
Hi.
Oh, hi. I'm very interested. I heard on a podcast that you were talking to a couple of lively foreign people, and you were talking about ayahuasca. Mother gave you a great kick in about your abuse with cannabis,
yes.
And you said that it displayed itself as an entity. Can you describe this more? Because I've had spooky experiences,
uh-huh.
And I watched Hammer House Horror when I was a kid.
Well, the entity that communicated with me is the entity that I call Mother Ayahuasca. And I see her in a number of different forms, sometimes as a human woman, sometimes as a jaguar, not the car, but the big cat, and sometimes as a serpent. And she was in serpent form at that point. It was a series of very powerful visions that caused me in October 2011 to quit a 24-year cannabis habit. And I went then 3 years without smoking any cannabis at all, until I found myself back on the Joe Rogan show in September 2014. And Joe and I, we were talking about cannabis, and Joe said, so you're still not smoking the cannabis? And I said, yeah, I'm not actually. But I said, you know, after 3 years, I'm wondering if it's time to dip my toes back in the water. And Joe says, well, how about now? I pulled out a joint, you know, so I smoked it with him on air. And it's amazing how one's tolerance level drops when you I somehow managed to hold it together, and at the end of it, I don't any longer feel the way that I felt about cannabis. I feel it's possible to have a relationship with cannabis that is not abusive, where I don't use it 24 hours a day, or anyway 16 hours a day, where it plays a small but useful part in my life rather than an overwhelming part in my life. And that's where I am with cannabis now. But on the entity issue, a big serpent. with really lovely eyes. Okay, next. Who's next? Yes?
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Where are you? Okay. Go ahead.
Earlier on, you had said that you didn't think the shamans humans had discovered DMT through trial and error.
No.
So how did they discover
it? Well, they say the spirits taught their ancestors how to do it. And perhaps the mechanism for that was an Nadanathara snuff, or the Yopo, you know. Perhaps that's where that encounter came, where the spirit said, by the way, there's a way you can extend this experience for 5 or 6 hours, you know, and gave them ayahuasca. That's what they say, and that's all I know. But as a feat of, if it were done by trial and error, it's an extraordinary achievement.
Yeah, sorry, what I was thinking is, so what process other than them being told indiscriminately that that was the thing to do, do you believe, or is, you just think it happened?
I think they were told by the spirits what to do. I think we are surrounded by other dimensions. I think those other dimensions are very real, and they interact with us whether we like it or not. Shamans get proactive about that and enter into those other dimensions, and they sometimes come back with news. They come back with information, with evidence, and not only shamans.
So,
scientists who drink ayahuasca often get insights into their field as well.
Sorry, but what I was trying to get at is that not like the infinite turtle thing whereby you just say, well, the thing before said that that was how it was, and therefore you go...
Well, no, not really. I think what they're saying is that a visionary encounter taught them this information, and that doesn't seem strange to me, because I wasn't a novelist until I drank ayahuasca, and then, you know, suddenly I became somebody who could write novels. This was totally new to me, so I received new information in that realm, which I was then able to deploy in my realm.
Yeah, okay, sorry, I don't take any more attention to this one, but in order to consume the thing, you have to have the information on how to consume it.
Yes, but the snuffs are very easy. You just snuff on one substance. You don't have to put together two different complete...
Okay, that was the answer, sorry.
Yeah. Next.
In terms of legal psychedelic use, how do you see it being integrated in our society in the future? Like, personally, I see it more as like a bar mitzvah, rite of passage, learning the ways of the world kind of ceremony happening, coming of age 18.
I actually don't think that we should prescribe the way that it will be used in the future.
I agree.
I think we should simply remove the barriers. I think we should legalize psychedelics and accompany that legalization with wise advice that people will believe. The problem at the moment is that the state agencies issuing their comments on drugs are disbelieved by everybody, with good reason, because they lie all the time. You know, once these substances are legalized, then we can have resources of really good, reliable information that people can go to, as adults do, to find out whether they want to do something or not. That's how. So I would say that what we need to do is to get rid of these very bad laws that have caused such a lot of harm, and then trust in humanity to put together the right solutions to deal with this in the future.
Great.
Yeah.
Oh. I'm Ian. Oh, you don't really need to look at me anyways.
I don't know what you are. Stand up, that'll make my life easier. Okay, you have a hat.
Just a comment we made about the Gnostic belief in
yes.
the church. Is that a belief that you hold, that there is a sort of archonic energy, demiurge, powerful being? I just say it because
yeah.
I was brought up by a Jehovah's Witness.
Uh-huh.
And Jehovah and the demiurge.
Yeah.
So I was brought up that way. Having a very big experience of it and being shunned from that, and now mm-hmm. coming. When I read, it was the back of your book about the. You mentioned the Gnostic belief.
Yeah.
And it was like a revelation to me, and it just sort of pulled me out of my guilt.
Good. I'm glad that it did. I think more people need to know about Gnosticism.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, actually profoundly subversive material. It undercuts everything that we've been taught is the case.
So do you...
Do I subscribe to that view? That we live in a university of duality? Yes, I do. I don't think duality is all that there is.
Definitely.
But I think it's a teaching system that we have here in this incarnation of this material plane. That's what this life has to offer. It has offered us teachings where we define ourselves and grow by the very choices we make between those poles, and perhaps beyond that there is a unity that we can get to.
Yeah, thanks very much for starting this whole journey off, and
thank you.
Cheers. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Question.
Yeah.
I'm what you might call an armchair activist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite vocal on social media, but I was wondering if you can give me advice of what I can physically do to bring about the change in laws and stop this war on drugs.
I think that more and more our members of parliament need to know that we don't want to vote for them unless they're going to take a serious look at the drug laws. This is not to be relegated as a trivial issue. This is a very important issue. People think there's all sorts of knee-jerk reactions that it's just about getting high, it's just trivial, it's not important. It's deeply, fundamentally important because it concerns adult sovereignty. And our sovereignty as adults is just being steamrolled by the state right now in this area. So we need to make it clear to our elected representatives that we will not vote for them unless they address this problem and do something about it. That's the way things work politically in our society, and we should use the system. It's beginning to work in America, you know? It's amazing, really, what's happening in America through grassroots activism. Now we have completely legal cannabis in Colorado, for example, and it's great to travel in Colorado these days. And actually, to be treated as an adult, you know, by fellow adults, it's a really good thing. So I would say that politicians do respond to the will of the public. If it's expressed forcefully enough to them. Another thing that brings it across is petition, which can show that there is support behind the nation. You need to change these laws, and then get behind people like the Beckley Foundation, who are really doing serious work at the legal level in solving these problems. Beckley Foundation, which is run by an amazing lady called Amanda Field. You'll find them on the internet. Cheers. Okay, next. Yes.
Excuse me, have you experienced wrath at all?
Stand up. What are you? Who's speaking? You, there you are. Okay, have I experienced?
Have you experienced wrath at all?
And did you say wrath?
Specific? Yeah, wrath.
Wrath.
I have a very broken relationship.
I experience wrath every time I encounter bureaucracy.
I have a very broken relationship with DMT, largely from overuse a period of time. I did the classic do-it-your-kitchen tech and wound up with more of it than anybody should have.
Yes.
And I was wondering how you best go about repairing your relationship with, as you said, Mother Ayahuasca.
Have you drunk ayahuasca or have you simply smoked DMT?
Simply smoked rather a large array of Changa Nexus.
Changa, yeah. Which is not as strong as you could get with some DMT. I mean, Changa can be very strong, but it's not pure DMT. Well, interesting. I would say I have seen people in DMT sessions roar and shout and scream as though they're wrestling with some inner demon. I don't know, is that what happens to you? Do you get very vocal in
it? It took an array of forms, ranging from things like taking very small dosages to reach threshold, and it lasting way longer than it should have, sitting there on DMT for 5 hours from one tiny little dose, and you're like, why is this happening to me?
Had you taken any monoamine oxidase?
Oh, no. This was just a small dose, but as I say, I have been doing small doses 5 to 6 times a day for 4 months.
Yeah. Thank you. Very, very dedicated. Very dedicated. I'm taking full advantage of DMT's quality, which is that no tolerance is ever built up. You can't build up tolerance.
I really wanted to know. I asked a lot of questions and not a lot of answers, and so I pushed it further and further and further, and it provided more and more of these wonderful questions, you know, these insights into your universe and your life, and
yeah,
the way things go, but it never provided any answers. Things are happening out of sequence, out of time,
yeah,
or I would experience minor changes in my dimension, like, for example, you'd be sitting there wearing a red t-shirt, you'd come back from the trip wearing a green t-shirt. Nothing else had changed but that.
Okay.
You'd see the guy in the room, I was wearing a red t-shirt, and they'd go, no, I'm not even wearing a red t-shirt.
Yeah. I think you ought to find somebody that has some good ayahuasca sessions and see what happens there. Ayahuasca, yeah, because with ayahuasca you have time to really work through the experience. I've heard DMT described as drug rape in a way, because DMT just utterly overwhelms you. There's no negotiation with it. I mean, it's like a rocket ship to the other side of reality. I've told this story before, but the DMT trip I had in October 2011, just prior to my ayahuasca sessions that caused me to give up cannabis for 3 years, in that DMT session, which followed in the same location the previous year, a number of beautiful, healing, lovely DMT sessions, I went into that session. I actually met Schultz, who made the film DMT, the Spirit Molecule, held the pipe for me. I was encouraged to take huge draws on the pipe. I got up to number four huge inhales. I have no place for wrath with DMT. I just collapse. I just went back on the bed. I can't even move. And then I found myself drawn into this really hellish realm. And a voice said to me, "You're ours now." And I said, "Fuck yes, but only for 12 minutes. And that is pretty much all I remember, apart from a feeling of horror. I find it helps to unpack experiences like that to work with ayahuasca, where there is more room for negotiation, where you can have time to integrate and learn from what you're doing. So I would say that would be the way to get closure on this issue. Yeah.
Hello.
Hello, where are you? Yes, hi.
You mentioned time in a talk in relation to abduction, and I was wondering what is the experience, how do you experience time when you take ayahuasca, and if it is different, why do you think so?
Yes, the experience of the flow of time is different with ayahuasca. But it can vary. You can have the sense that you've only been there for a few minutes and actually it was a few hours, or it can be the other way around. But this isn't surprising, really. I mean, our experience of time does vary according to the circumstances we're in. I mean, time can appear to pass very slowly, but if you stand under a nice cold shower, I mean, time can appear to pass very fast, but if you stand under a nice cold shower, it'll pass very slowly. And I think that there is a definite sense of time as a dimension in ayahuasca. It is an element of the process. I hope that answers your question. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Hi. My question is about the pinecone staff.
Yes.
That was in one of your talks. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that's just a reference to the pineal gland? Or might that be another form of symbolism about that particular genus of plants in pine trees?
Where beneath which Amanita muscaria grow, as a matter of fact, very often. Is that what your thought is? I mean, why would they want to specify that particular genus? What's special about it?
If you get up my email, I'll be able to tell you more about it. Okay. But I really want to bore everyone.
All right.
Very long.
Tell me more, but I warn you that I get so many emails that I may not be able to
respond
to them. But send it, I'll have a look, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to be here for a while longer. I will sit there. Anybody wants to come and say hello, whenever I'm there, I'm here for you.